thank you very much. If you've got any final thoughts, then we can throw them in and then pick up final thoughts from the audience as well, I guess. I mean, just listening to Rick and David there and musing a bit on the day as we come to the end of it, and it struck me we've been probably quite a diverse group here today, but with this sense, which was articulated actually, and particularly when the four figures were up in the morning, about, on the one hand, service, as Marilyn put it, how the parts are in the service of the whole. And then I think Malcolm talked about a kind of humility, and Jessica too, that releases the ego actually and frees the individual self to become co-worker. Which Rick was mentioning there, this sense that this is part of our calling, which you find in different spiritual traditions. And that feels a hopeful note that there is, that's been in the air here even today, I think, that sense of being in service to the greater whole. And then I think that links to something which is rather wonderful, which is a sense of freedom. It actually frees you up. And from Barfield, Steiner, and others, this idea that freedom is a good kind of compass for all this. To use the phrase that's in the Gospels for Jesus, you know, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And I think that that's really crucial, that even in the struggle and the darkness, this sense that if we're stepping into a lighter space where we feel there's more movement, perhaps, maybe there's more love. It's not that there's no sorrow or weeping, but the sorrow and weeping can happen and it can move. It doesn't get stuck. The psychotherapist in me wants to say, you know, it's not that you don't feel anything anymore, but you're able to keep moving in a kind of freedom for all these different feelings. You don't get caught in a kind of rigidity, which can become neurotic and so on. So that sense of freedom for me has been around. Also, just what was being said there, this business of sort of following the energy without trying to pin it down too quickly. I think this is a big theme in Barfield. When he talks about parables, for example, and also about poetry, he's saying very much, kind of let it work on you. And this is part of this reorientation to picking up on the spiritual beings, calling them, having an open mind and heart. And learning to do that a lot more feels really, really important to me. And I think part of that is about realizing that we're engaged fundamentally in a spiritual transformation. Certainly in the Christian world that I know anyway, and it can often get reduced too quickly to a kind of set of moral demands, as if we've got to try and fix things. We've got to, as it were, make a difference now. And the point about things like justice and so on is there's nothing wrong with them, of course not. But if we're not careful, it becomes a kind of spiritual materialism, I think. And when we're actually following an agenda of this world, rather than trying to keep at least half of us open to this deeper spiritual transformation, which can bring in another world. So I feel that that's been sort of hovering around the edges for me in the last few minutes. And just a final extra thought there. I'm very keen on the work of Jeffrey Kripal, the American psychologist. And I think one of his key insights is that when we're engaging with this spiritual world, whether it's through paranormal experiences, maybe through astrology, the various ways that that can happen to us, he says it's always reflexive. And there's always a kind of discernment that's required. We mustn't get literal and concrete about it. We must understand that actually the truth of these experiences comes up in the third space that happens between us and the experience, or between us and the interpretation, between us and the movement. Because it's, and this is not just because we're engaging with things we don't fully understand, but it's because this very movement is trying to take us into a different experience of reality, a different level of things. It is a spiritual transformation. So we should always expect that we have to do the work of interpretation, the hermeneutical work, to use an old-fashioned term, because that is what it itself lifts us. This is the transcendent function of Jung, this reflexive idea, to work on that as well. So just a few thoughts to pick up some more. Anyone else would like to add anything? Or maybe we can... Yeah.
I just want to touch on this notion of the reality principle that Rick just mentioned, and then earlier in his talk there, he said that he didn't know what it was like here, but he knew in the States that reality was in danger. And I have to say that struck me very close to home because I've written a book, I think, about what Rick was talking about the situation in the States with the world of alternative facts and post-truth. And not to name names, but I think the most recently elected president of the United States, there's this thing called the singularity that people have been waiting for a long time. And, you know, in physics, astrophysics, singularity is the black hole where everything is different. Once you get to the black hole, the laws of physics change. They break down. They're not the same. And then in kind of new age kind of philosophy, there's this notion down the line, historically, something's going to happen that's a singularity and everything's going to be different. You know, there's going to be a big neon sign coming up over the horizon saying new age has arrived. But I think when this most recent presidential election in the United States was over, the singularity had arrived. I think it had come because everything was different after that. And it really made me feel that reality was threatened. Reality was under attack by forces that have taken ideas about the notion that reality is kind of malleable, that imagination can affect reality. I mean, we all sort of didn't like the idea that, okay, science tells us this is real and that's it, there's nothing you can do, the imagination is just in your head and it doesn't have no effect on the outer world out there. But then we've had for several years now, from different sources, starting, say, with quantum physics, with the whole idea of the observer and the observed, that, you know, there's no separation between the two and you observe something, you're affecting it. And then in the academic world with things like postmodernism and deconstructionism, there is no truth with a big capital T and there's no reality with a big R. And then even in sort of the esoteric world where we did want to somehow have some effect on reality. Well, I think all that has come home to roost, as Rick said, but not in a way that we wanted it to. And in a way, like, I think we have to protect reality now. We have to really get a grasp on the things that are real and important and, you know, have a strong kind of sense of defense for them, because there are people out there who have dubious purposes and they are quite ready to go for it. So, oh, reality's up for grabs. There's no reality with a capital R. There's no truth with a capital T. We all create our own reality. Fine, I'm going to go for it. So I think that's something that we have to keep in mind. And reality is something that's malleable and it does change over time. And we said earlier that the imagination has something to do with that. And the more we become aware of that, the more we become aware of our own responsibility in that action that's taking place now. So, I mean, in a simple kind of sense, I would say, make sure what's going on inside your head is what you want to go on inside your head, and not leave it. I mean, it's good to have an open mind, but if you keep it open too much, too many things you don't want will walk in, and they'll squat. You know, they'll take up residency there. So I think you have to be very careful about that. And if one thing to walk away from this today, which is, to me, it's incredibly encouraging that we had so much time here and so many people interested in this, that we can take seriously the whole idea of making sure we're the one furnishing that inner world.
I just wanted to say something fairly brief, which is, I mean, I very much heard what somebody said about does anybody else here feel embarrassed to talk about this stuff out in the real world, as it were? I mean, do you feel unable to talk in the way that we've talked here? And I think many of us do. I know I do. I find it, you know, very intimidating. And so I tend not to do it. So I think that I want to really just reflect how important it is that this group here, this large group here, has felt able to talk in such an open and understanding way with such a diversity of experience that is also so common. I think we really should not ignore how important that is to everything that we've been just talking about, actually, the importance of the imagination, the importance of, you know, right behavior, acting together. Here we are, you know, it has been an amazing day, but in the sense that there's no time and no space, this is a group that can continue outside this room with the memory of what happened today, and that is, I think, a very powerful imaginative intention to take forward. So I'd like to do that.
Yeah, I was going back to what you were just saying last about we have to be careful about, you know, what we let in as well. And I'm not against at all appealing to spiritual beings in the invisible. But I think there is also in that invisible potentially spiritual beings that are not necessarily benign. And just because it's the invisible and the unknown doesn't mean that there is a resource there that we don't have to be discerning about. But I'm not against if people feel that's something they should be doing. But I would, at the same time, suggest there is caution required.
To that briefly, is that there's a whole tradition dealing with precisely that. Barfield was very concerned about what the products of undisciplined imagination would create, and Madame Blavatsky got into a lot of trouble with the spiritualist community because she said at the seances, the entities that you're getting in touch with, it's not Aunt Betty and it's not Napoleon, it's the equivalent of astral hobos who have nothing better to do, and they're waiting for anybody to get in touch with them, and they'll tell you whatever you want to hear, and they'll communicate and tell you anything you want because that's what they want. They want to maintain the contact with the physical world. And there's a whole tradition of this, and this is something Henri Corbin, I mentioned him earlier, the great French phenomenologist and scholar of Persian mysticism. He too said, like, imagination is the key. The imagination is a precise tool. With which we can chart and navigate our way through a precise mode of reality, but we have to have a disciplined imagination. And he looked to the Hermetic tradition and other spiritual traditions who provided a kind of guidebook, a sort of thing like that. So I think you're absolutely right. We have to be careful about that. And the other thing is, too, is the spiritual powers are pretty tough. I mean, I don't know if you know Rilke's poem, the Duino Elegies. In the beginning of the poems, he says, you know, who if I cried in the angelic orders would hear me? And when they finally do hear him, he says, you know, every angel is terrible. You know, beauty is the beginning of a terror that we're just able to bear. So, I mean, it's nice to have all the lovely little paintings and New Age drawings of angels, and they're all fluffy and they're very friendly and all that. But they're powerful, powerful forces. And we really have to, you know, be careful, as you said, you know, in dealing with them. You have to devise some way to be able to discern, you know, good from the bad or the helpful from the ones that aren't helpful.
Yes, thank you very much. I just want to bring some hope into this. I know I'm just a speck of dust, but I believe there is a reality. There is a real reality that we can all rely on, you know, call it eternity, call it the eternal. There is a greater truth that I don't think changes, which is bigger than all of us. I believe that when we come to pass over, to die, that, you know, a lot of it makes sense. So I just want to come back to the here and now. And yes, you know, I think society is largely socially constructed anyway. I mean, I'm doing family history and I'm dwelling in the Holocaust. I mean, that was absolute madness, you know, what went on. You could feel the same in America right now. It's complete madness. But the point is, it's all there to test you. It's about character development, and you've got to stick to your own sense of righteousness and what's right. So, for instance, going back to the Holocaust, you know, there were righteous people who took in refugees, who took in, you know, and there was those who were in the resistance. You can look at positive and inspirational. And I think today we've got Extinction Rebellion and all this going on. So I think we have choices, unlimited choices, to continue on our own path of goodness. I do feel be careful of being cynical and upset. You know, if you go back to the spiritual forces, yes, I completely agree, there's goodness, but there is definitely evil, if you like, dark forces, and be careful with spirituality, be careful with, you know, seances and all this business, paranormal, just be really careful. I would rather go to a church and pray to God and praise and goodness and become stronger with positivity and goodness and service, as Marilyn said, serving the whole, rather than looking for something exciting and titillating, because you could be led astray without realizing it. And, you know, anyway, to come back. So I feel that we're living in interesting times and so on, but it's a chance for a paradigm shift, and don't lose hope, because there's a bigger picture and it's all perfect.
This is a question for Richard. In your Passion of the Western Mind, you spoke about, philosophically, about participation, which is such a wonderful direction in which we're going as a society, perhaps, but it certainly opened our talk today on that. You don't say an awful lot about it, and it'd be very nice to know what you think about its sort of recent its history in modern philosophy, where it's going, because if one can persuade the academy that this is philosophically sound, that would be a very good basis for a much more positive society, I think. So I'd be interested in your philosophical views on participation, consciousness.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, when I remember when I was writing the epilogue to Passion of the Western Mind, which was originally a paper in Cambridge University, there a conference called Philosophy and the Human Future. And I was just looking for a single term to describe. I was particularly focused on the epistemological challenges of the postmodern time, and then went to the idea of a participatory epistemology. It was back in 89, drawing on the work of many of the people that you've been speaking of here today, Goethe and Steiner, Barfield, Emerson, and so forth. And it's been quite remarkable how participation, with its very multivalent, you know, very richly multiple ways in which it can be understood and unpacked, how much participation has become more and more discussed in the public intellectual world and in the, particularly, of course, the countercultural intelligentsia, of which I would say places like the Scientific and Medical Network, communities like that, Schumacher, CIIS, Esalen Institute, places that we are there and here are very much part of. It's become central. I think. And there have been books on the participatory turn, for example, is a very good anthology that was of scholarly essays that the State University of New York Press published. It was edited by Jorge Ferrer and Jacob Sherman with many excellent contributions. So participation is becoming, more discussed, and I think it's almost the inevitable, if I can use the term, kind of dialectical fulfillment of where postmodernity is going. Depending on how I prefer to describe the postmodern in a more embracing sense that includes its nobility as well as that shadow side of kind of deconstructive fragmentation and nihilism with which underlying rigid materialism that occludes a lot of the metaphysical possibilities. That's true. That is part of the postmodern, and it has been dominant in the academic world. But I certainly see there's been evolving a shift in the wind. It never goes as fast as any of us want it to. And the fact of the matter is we need it to go much faster given the acceleration of evolutionary and historical crisis in our time. But it's often the crisis that produces the acceleration of change that is needed. And again, I have a certain faith in, I don't know on what time scale that this will take place, but participation, which simultaneously recognizes the kind of like the breakthroughs of the formation of the modern self in its rational moral autonomy. which in some sense was an interjection of the divine transcendent that it inherited out of Christianity and Judaism. That great painting of Michelangelo's creation moment on the Sistine Chapel, it's so iconic in part because that is the moment in which, whether it's in the scientific revolution that's unfolding right at that moment with Copernicus, or in the painters themselves, or in the new religious autonomy that's bursting at the seams there with the Protestant Reformation, it captures the moment in which there's a divine human transmission with all the potential danger of the inflation and the hubris of the modern. And the beauty of participation is that it takes that positive gift of the modern, I would call it the internalization of the axial breakthrough that takes place in the modern period. It takes that and it breaks it out of the alienation that the hubristic side of the modern anthropocentric disenchanting project carried. It breaks it out of it and it allows us to participate back into the anima mundi, but with our agency intact and all the discernment, which I couldn't catch everything that many people were talking about because the microphones aren't, it isn't picked up on the computer. I could only catch some of it. But some of what I heard seemed to be talking about the extraordinary importance of discernment when it comes to opening ourselves to the spiritual domain and various spiritual beings. It takes tremendous discernment, and there's nothing, you know, the same good and evil that exists in the human sphere is also true in the spiritual sphere. And so that's why our moral autonomy and our discernment, our capacity for clarity of discernment is so crucial in this participatory act that is necessary. So anyway, those are a couple of themes. I do see participation becoming more and more central. It's part of, you know, people in like Peter Reason have been developing it for years there in the UK in the area of inquiry and the social sciences. And I think it's an inevitable intellectual development that will get, it'll be inevitably stronger and stronger.
Thank you very much indeed for that. I mean, that was actually a very nice summary that took me back to some of the things which you were saying right at the top of the day. So that was lovely to hear, actually. Thank you for the question and then those thoughts.